That's Steve Torrey, one of my favorites, with Rainbow People. It's the title track of his 14th album. That's back in 2008, titled, of course, Rainbow People. Steve Torrey on trombone and shells. Yes, he is a seashellist. It's a new category of musician in a way, but he's excellent at it. We have Kenny Garrett on alto sax, Mulgrew Miller on piano and keyboards, Peter Washington on bass, and Ignacio Berroa on drums. Oh, by the way, for the benefit of Donald Trump, Steve Torrey was born to Mexican-American parents, yes, indeedy, and has been in the world of Latin jazz and rock. He's been on Saturday Night Live's orchestra for more than 30 years now, and he's been in the world of jazz for more than 52 years. Incredible. One of my all-time favorites. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we are spending our hour with our professor in fact, Dr. Gerald Horn. I'm hearing some beeps going on here. Dr. Gerald Horn is the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. And he, as you know, is a frequent analyst here of world affairs on Lead Stories. He's going to tell us what we need to know about President Obama's 10th pivot to Asia trip, what's behind the push against Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro and Brazil's Dilma Rousseff, Britain's June 23rd referendum on whether to leave the European Union, and Hillary Clinton's drag, as it were, on President Obama's legacy. Dr. Horn also teaches diplomatic history. He is the author of more than 30 books, including, most recently, Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary, Confronting Black Jacobins, The U.S., The Haitian Revolution, and The Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Race to Revolution, The U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. In addition, he has written more than 100 scholarly papers that focus on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. And the last time we talked, Gerald, you were in London, I presume, doing more research for yet another book. Happy to have you with us today. Uh-oh, we're having some connectivity issues with Gerald. We keep losing him. So we'll hopefully connect with him very shortly. Sometimes these things happen. People are in areas, sometimes it even happens to me, where the reception is not that strong or it is kind of skittish. So we'll keep at that. But what we will be talking about today is to get a fix on these global issues. We can't talk about everything, but we tackle some of the important things, including those issues that have gotten considerable coverage, but not necessarily telling us what we need to know. And this is where Gerald Horn is excellent and exceptional in giving us an entirely different point of view. I think, though, in this round, I would like to open up the forum, not just to be an interview between Gerald and myself, but to also include your questions. So if you have questions about these particular areas, we will try and see if we can conduct a direct line between you and Dr. Gerald Horn, because so many people have been asking me about ways in which to have that done. So maybe this is a good time to do that. I also, in the meantime, while we're trying to reconnect with him, I want to thank you so very much. I got such a wonderful outpouring of congratulations on my 22nd birthday. Actually, I'm 63. I don't hide it. Yesterday, thank you so very much for your kind thoughts and your incredible supportive messages. I just appreciate it so much. So thank you for that. And I want to say that it is a great privilege for me always to be here with you. And we are forming a community. That's what's most exciting to me. So I don't know why we are getting signals, but we keep getting signals of, are we? Okay, great. Gerald, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay. The last time we spoke, you were in London. I imagine you're researching yet another book.
Absolutely.
What's it going to be on?
Sorry?
What is it going to be on?
Well, I was working on a number of books in London. One was on 17th century slavery, with an emphasis on North America, Jamaica, and Barbados. Another one on the defeat of apartheid in 1994, the run-up to that, stretching over decades. And then I'm working on another book on jazz studies.
That's
Hello?
Great. That's great.
Okay.
Well, we are going to be tackling four particular areas today. We're talking about President Obama's pivot to Asia trip, his 10th. What's behind the push against Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro and Brazil's Dilma Rousseff? Britain's June 23rd referendum on whether to leave the European Union. And Hillary Clinton's possible drag on Obama's legacy. Let's tackle Britain first. We have coming up on June the 23rd a referendum there on whether Britain should leave the European Union. Considering you were just there, what did you sense as the mood toward this issue?
Well, first of all, those who are calling for Brexit, that is to say the British exit from the European Union, increasingly have been relying upon the question of anti-immigration. That is to say, they're arguing that Britain cannot control its borders as long as it's part of the European Union. So therefore, the Brexit is taking a very nasty turn. According to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, who of course is in favor of Britain remaining in the EU, he says that they're relying upon anti-immigration because they cannot put forward an economic argument with regard to Brexit. That is to say that many of the think tanks and, of course, many of the institutions in London of the government have argued that Brexit would be a disaster for Britain. I should also say that if Brexit takes place, it's more than likely that Scotland will seek to exit the United Kingdom because it would want to be part of the European Union. And therefore, you could see the decomposition of Great Britain altogether, which would be a blow to its transatlantic ally, speaking of the United States of America. There's one more point about Brexit I should mention that may be relevant to the U.S. election in November, and that is that many who are in favor of Brexit are apparently reluctant to reveal that sentiment to pollsters, because they're embarrassed to say that they're in favor of Brexit, because Brexit is now increasingly associated with anti-immigrant fervor, and that's now being considered a position not acceptable in so-called respectable circles. You may know that a similar phenomenon may be operating in the U.S. presidential election. That is to say that many or some who plan to vote for Donald J. Trump will not necessarily reveal that to pollsters, given the fact that they are embarrassed. And so, therefore, we may not know who is in front of the election until the first Wednesday in November. And what's interesting to me about that is that many commentators have drawn a parallel between the so-called Know-Nothing movement in the United States in the 1850s, which was anti-immigration, particularly anti-Irish Catholic immigration, with Irish Catholics fleeing across the Atlantic in the wake of the potato famine. And so, therefore, the Know-Nothing Party sometimes will win elections out of the blue. That is to say that they were not necessarily considered a factor until the day after the election when their vote totals skyrocketed. So that's something to pay attention to, it seems to me, as we approach the first Tuesday in November in the USA.
Well, what is interesting is that the faction that is pushing for exit, the Brexit movement, British leaving, exiting the European Union, is that it is mirroring a very rightward push throughout Europe. I know, for example, the French National Front leader, Marine Le Pen, and others in Germany and the Netherlands and elsewhere, they are insisting on the breakup of the European Union. What's behind the push for Brexit?
Well, I think that in the transatlantic community generally, there is this perception that globalization has not worked out very well for the working class. That is to say that with the collapse of the socialist camp, particularly the Soviet Union 25 years ago, and the triumph that that signaled, although it did not become apparent immediately, the triumph that that signaled for global capital meant that global capital became more mobile and could shift jobs to basically any place on the planet, and that drove the working class and the transatlantic community into competition, for example, with workers in Eastern Europe and workers in Africa and workers in China. And so now, in many cases, certain segments of the working class, particularly the Euro-American working class, are saying, stop the world, we want to get off. That is to say that this globalization has gone too far. What's interesting, too, about the Trump phenomenon is that in some ways it's beginning to mirror the National Front in France. That is to say, up until the rise of Trump, you had the right wing, backed by a good sector of the working class, in many ways calling for a curtailment of Social Security, calling for a curtailment of the kinds of social welfare benefits. And what's interesting, of course, is that the National Front in France has taken the position that they're in favor of these social welfare benefits. They're just opposed to those benefits being extended to newly arrived immigrants or to French nationals who may not be of so-called pure European descent. Well, that's the direction in which the Trump train is now going. I should also mention another point that is very disturbing, I must say. The New York Times a few days ago ran an article about how the Trump phenomenon may be signaling a rise of a global fascism, which was interesting on the part of the New York Times. But what's striking is that this article and a number of other articles that appeared since have not deigned to mention that if you talk about fascism in the United States, how can you talk about that without talking about state terror against black people? Or how can you talk about fascism without talking about terror inflicted on black people by non-state actors, such as Dylann Roof in South Carolina or George Zimmerman in Florida? How can you talk about fascism without talking about this mass incarceration? So once again, there's this sort of wall that's thrown up between what's happening to people of color and black people on the one hand and what's supposedly happening in the larger body politic. But what that kind of dichotomy is signaling, I'm afraid, is that the idea that goes back to the 19th century, the United States is a white man's country, and therefore what happens to those of us who are not, quote, white, is irrelevant. But I'm afraid to say that we all live in the same country, whether people want to recognize that or not. And the coarsening of sentiment that is a product of this terror against black people certainly is helping to shed light on why there might be the rise of this neo-fascist movement. And the sooner we recognize that, the better. But I'm afraid to say that it does not look like that'll be recognized in certain circles anytime soon.
One thing I wanted to explore is what this movement has put on trial is the whole concept of macroeconomics, if you will. Here, the rationale for the formation of the European Union was a consolidation of just what you were talking about, a European powerhouse, economic powerhouse. Now it seems as if that the very rationale for its formation is coming under direct attack, from the right and ultra-right, and coming under attack as we see a kind of balkanization on racial grounds, just like you're pointing out here. You have the European world finally having to face some truths about its macroeconomic model as against the rest of the world. Greece has already put that to the test, Greece being not a European country in the sense that we understand whiteness on a global level. So is this part of the – but it still remains, in my view, a closeted argument. Have you found it to be part of the general discourse?
Well, what your comment brings to mind is this. In terms of disconnects, there is another one that should be mentioned that's part of the original agenda for this afternoon. That is to say that if you read the New York Times, the Washington Post, and follow the U.S. press, they're cheerleading for the fall of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, for the ouster of Maduro in Venezuela, for the jailing of former Argentine President Cristina Kirchner in Buenos Aires, and basically cheerleading for a swing to the right in this hemisphere, which of course will make it easier for U.S. capital to find a compliant labor movement and therefore move their plants and their enterprises from the United States into South America, which will further impoverish the U.S. working class and the Euro-American working class and make that class more susceptible to the blandishments and the siren songs of Donald J. Trump, who these same elite organs, the New York Times and the Washington Post, tell us that they're opposed to Donald Trump. So obviously there's a certain kind of incoherence in their approach. That is to say, they're cheerleading for policies that are leading to a domestic result that they say they abhor. And apparently they don't see the contradiction, just like they don't see the contradiction about talking about the rise of fascism without talking about police terror and non-state actor terror towards black people. And there's another factor, too, that I'm afraid is part of the recipe. It might be the most dangerous element. One of the things that struck me during my trip to London, which just ended a few days ago, is all of this loose talk about war with Russia. I mean, a former top British leader of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which includes the United States, has just written a novel called War with Russia 2017. Now, this is madness. I mean, this is accompanied by a lot of anti-Moscow propaganda, as John McCain once said, Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country, a denigrating of Russia's economy, which certainly has problems. But on the other hand, anybody who pays attention to NASA, the Space Administration of the United States, knows the United States is heavily dependent upon this so-called underdeveloped country, Russia, in terms of boosting its rockets. And in any case, even if that were not the case, the idea of going to war with a nuclear power is worse than insanity. It's madness. But that's a part of this crisis that we're facing, oftentimes economic crises, as we know from studying World War II, for example. Oftentimes the factors leading up to war are, in fact, economic crises. That is to say, no accident that preceding World War II is the Great Depression. And in many ways, it's World War II that drags the capitalist economies out of the Great Depression. But the problem in 2016 is that we have these weapons of mass destruction, which could mean the extinction of all humanity. But not only that, but it's also accompanied by ratcheting up tensions with China as well. I'm sure you're following what's happening with the South China Sea and the United States aircraft buzzing Chinese personnel on these contested islands, and how the U.S. administration is now slapping sanctions on Chinese steel, which is not going down very well in Beijing, and is leading some to think that some sort of trade war is in the offing with China, which obviously tracks the philosophy of Donald J. Trump, in many ways preempts the philosophy of Donald J. Trump. At the same time, the United States is trying to sanction Chinese banks that are dealing with North Korea, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. You might have noted that for one of the first times in recent years, a leading North Korean official met with the Chinese president in China. So this economic crisis that these North Atlantic countries are facing, that's reflected in the rise of Donald J. Trump and also the rise of Brexit, also has a military component. And I should also say that the Tory Party, the party of Prime Minister David Cameron in London, in Britain, is terribly split on the question of Brexit. As a matter of fact, those Tories who are in favor of Brexit, of course, Cameron is part of the Remain camp, Remain in the European Union, but the pro-Brexit Tories are saying that unless Cameron can win this referendum by a rate of 6-4, that he's toast. He's out of here. He's going to be subjected to an internal party coup, and a more right-wing figure will be placed in the prime minister's office at number 10 Downing Street. And what that will mean, of course, is that the cannons of war will approach with ever more assistance. Hello?
Yes. We're having some... Where I am, they just issued a major weather warning advisory, and the connectivity is a bit static at the moment since we're expecting heavy rain and possible tornadoes, but we'll see. The president just returned from his 10th trip to Asia, and it looks like for the rest of the year, up until November, as a matter of fact, he is going to be out of the country doing a farewell tour. In March, he went to Cuba and Argentina. April, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, Germany. May, of course, last month, it was Vietnam and Japan. This month, it will be Canada, meeting with the president there as well of Mexico. July, Poland for the NATO summit. August, in Brazil. September, in China for the G20 summit, and Laos for the East Asia summit, and November in Peru for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. Now, all of this is predicated on drumming up business. What else do you see? How do you interpret the president's farewell tour in terms of foreign policy?
Well, first of all, part of the farewell tour is about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That is to say, this new trade deal that is seeking to exclude China and is oftentimes described as NAFTA on steroids, the North American Free Trade Agreement on steroids. And I should also say that part of this travel is about a transatlantic equivalent to the TPP that would yoke the economies of the European Union to that of the United States. And what's striking is that both of these measures are in many ways a response to the rise of China. There's a lot of hysteria right now. I'm not sure if it's trickling into the left-wing circles in the United States, but certainly in ruling elite circles, there's a lot of hysteria right now about the rise of China. But what's helping to buffer that hysteria is the fact that there's this intertwining of the U.S. and Chinese economies. And so, for example, one propagandist for the U.S. ruling elite, Nicholas Lardy, in this morning's Financial Times, has an article poo-pooing the idea that Chinese banks might be in trouble. In other words, you have U.S. leading propagandists who are not necessarily trying to raise a hysterical propaganda about the Chinese economy, because the U.S. economy is so linked to the Chinese economy. But at the same time, you have the U.S. administration, which has as its mandate to take into account the overall interests of the U.S. ruling elite, which is really beating the drums with regard to this anti-China maneuver. That was the whole point of Mr. Obama's trip to Vietnam, and you might have noticed that the arms embargo against Vietnam is being gradually lifted. That was the point, it seems to me, President Obama's trip to Hiroshima, not an apology for the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki some 70-odd years ago, but certainly an attempt to carry favor in Japanese ruling elite circles, because Japan would be a keystone of any kind of squeeze that would be placed upon Beijing. The problem there, from the U.S. point of view, is that ideally Japan could also be enlisted in terms of a squeeze on Russia. But right now, that seems to be a no-go. In fact, the Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, has met so many times with Vladimir Putin in the last few years that people are beginning to talk that they must have some sort of thing going on, because they're meeting on a regular, periodic basis. I mean, it's really incredible. I mean, you might recall that Shinzo Abe went to the Sochi Olympics in 2014 when most of the members of the G7, the group of seven leading capitalist economies, stayed away. And, of course, we know why that's the case, because Tokyo elite circles are very concerned that if push comes to shove and the conflict escalates with China and Japan, they don't want Russia breathing down the necks of Tokyo as well. But the problem from Washington's point of view is that once you remove Japan from the anti-Moscow chessboard, it makes conflict with Russia more problematic. It makes it much more cumbersome. And so I think that that helps to account for this frenetic traveling that Barack Obama is now involved in. He's trying to set the table for his successor, presumably Hillary Rodham Clinton. Although what's striking there is that it's not clear if Secretary Clinton will be the successor. And in any case, she's going to be running to the right of Donald J. Trump on a number of key issues. Keep in mind that Donald J. Trump, of course, has said some very positive things about Vladimir Putin. And although he's been castigated for that by Secretary Clinton, in some ways what Trump is saying about Moscow mirrors what Obama was saying about Moscow in 2009 with the reset, which was all about embracing Moscow so as to better pivot towards Beijing. But that didn't work out very well after Russia seized Crimea from the Ukraine, and then sanctions were then slapped on Moscow. Keep in mind as well that Donald J. Trump has talked about having talks with the North Korean leadership, and he's been denounced, including today in her speech in San Diego by Secretary Clinton. But with the tensions and these ominous clouds of war taking place as we speak, it's very unfortunate that Secretary Clinton finds it necessary to take positions to the right of Donald J. Trump, when in any case, she's going to have a heck of a time defeating him in an election.
Well, we're seeing ominous clouds of the old-fashioned phrase, a regime change right here in the hemisphere, and I'm referring specifically to the governments of Venezuela and Brazil. What is your take on why these two nations seem to be in the crosshairs of American foreign policy at the moment?
Well, before I answer that question, I want to ask you a question. I know you have very good contacts in Trinidad and Tobago, and given Venezuela's proximity to Trinidad and Tobago, I'm wondering if there are any reverberations in Trinidad as to what's happening in Venezuela. For example, are there refugees coming into Trinidad, into Port of Spain now, or people flying or rowing the few miles?
It's interesting because Trinidad is right off the coast of Venezuela, and there's a long-standing relationship there. But Trinidad is now undergoing its own catharsis due to widespread allegations of corruption and the disappearance of a lot of oil money from the treasury. So that is happening. Trinidad is more of an oil refining nation than an oil producing nation, but it does receive a huge chunk of its revenue from refining oil. And since there has been a serious downgrade in the volume of oil arriving in Trinidad for refining, this is where the crude is broken up into the various byproducts. The national treasury has been seriously affected. So they're going through their own problems and trying to get at the root of why the country, despite the fact that it had a healthy economy based largely on oil refining, suddenly finds itself practically with an empty treasury. So that's been the tandem consequence of what's going on in Venezuela and in some of the other oil-producing countries. So I imagine it would not be too long, because there's always been a history of people going back and forth between Trinidad and Venezuela being so close to each other.
Well,
but
what that reminds me of,
though, why do you think, do you sense that what is happening in Venezuela with the direct attack on the government of Nicolas Maduro, with a direct attack against Dilma Rousseff, although for different reasons, but we sense the same kind of pattern that was directed, let's say, at Muammar Gaddafi, this idea that Hillary Rodham Clinton pushed so strenuously, and she wasn't the only one, but under foreign policy, unquote, this notion of regime change and fomenting internal problems in order to essentially achieve that. Are we there? Have we lost him? Okay. Have we lost Gerald?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
My response is this. First of all, with regard to these manifest problems in Venezuela, that is to say, with government offices being shut down 3 days out of a 5-day work week, with blackouts in terms of electricity, with shortages of consumer goods, including toilet paper, this is obviously a reflection of the fact that, number one, the elites of Venezuela have turned against the Maduro regime, and secondly, they're receiving a certain kind of backing from the North Atlantic communities, not just in the United States. Keep in mind that Lufthansa, the German airline, just suspended flying into Caracas, as well as a number of other leading airlines of the North Atlantic nations, and this is increasing the isolation of Venezuela. It's really turning the screws on the Maduro regime. What's even more striking are these rather blatant calls from the Venezuelan elite, oftentimes echoed in Washington, for the military to intervene and overthrow this government, which I thought would be perceived as anti-democratic, and I thought that these folks were in favor of democracy. Silly me. But in any case, fly in the ointment there is that, recall that during the early days of the first Hugo Chavez regime, that there had been an attempt by the military to overthrow Hugo Chavez. In fact, you might have seen the documentary film about that. And what happened after that abortive coup d'etat, which, by the way, was not only backed in Washington, but there was an editorial in the New York Times, if you go back and check the record, saluting the coup when they thought it was going to succeed. But after the coup collapsed, what happened is that part of Cuba's assistance, a multifaceted assistance of Venezuela, was bringing in Cuban military to help to train, if you like, or what the opponents would call indoctrinate, the Venezuelan military in a more patriotic fashion. And thus far,
have to underline thus far, it does not appear as if the military will be turning against the Maduro regime. But things are so desperate in Caracas right now, I don't think we can rule anything out. At the same time, as your comment about Trinidad and Tobago tended to suggest, there are ripples emanating from Venezuela throughout the Caribbean, not only in Trinidad and Tobago, but keep in mind that part of the Chavez policy towards Caribbean mm-hmm. nations were the so-called Petro-Caribe policy, the subsidized oil to places like Jamaica and Haiti, et cetera. Well, it's very difficult for Venezuela to keep up its end of the bargain with regard to providing subsidies to Jamaica, Haiti, et cetera. And to the extent that those subsidies are reduced or removed, that's obviously going to have a negative fallout in the Caribbean. Now, the OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Nations, are meeting as we speak in Vienna. And as you know, Venezuela is part of OPEC. The problem with Venezuela is that price of a barrel of oil was about $110 about a year ago. A few weeks ago, it was about 30 or 35. Now it's up to 50. But that's still not enough to bring not only the economy of Venezuela out of doldrums, but the economy of Angola and Nigeria and other oil-producing nations. I should also say Russia at the same time. The Saudis hold the cards there, and they're determined to pursue this policy of keeping oil prices at a certain level. We had thought that it was part of a U.S.-Saudi strategy to put the squeeze on Russia and Venezuela. Then it seemed as if it was part of a Saudi strategy to put the squeeze on U.S. oil producers because the Saudis were concerned about the growth in U.S. domestic oil production. But in any case, $50 a barrel for oil is not enough to help to drag the Venezuela economy out of its present crisis. And so we can expect to see part of what we've been seeing for the past few weeks in Venezuela. That is to say, long lines, angry demonstrators, et cetera.
And this is a perfect recipe when you find such dissatisfaction internally in any country over what people see as the basics, you know, toilet paper, sugar, food. The stories they're just every day you read stories about people, I mean, extraordinary circumstances. For example, I read a story a couple of days ago about people in Brazil and in Venezuela now reduced to killing animals, stray dogs and so forth, in order to have something to eat. Now, instantly, you get a sense that this is also propaganda, not that it is not happening, not that it isn't real. It is quite possible that these things are real and are happening. But we have to look at the fact that what Venezuela and Brazil have in common, of course, is tremendous natural resources. The United States has had a dismal history of imperialism, particularly based on what the country sees as an advantage of acquiring the resources of other countries through this kind of foment that is raging and in creating this kind of foment. I wondered whether you saw some of the familiar patterns of how imperialism expresses itself and creates or aids and abets these kinds of internal problems and strife in order to agitate and essentially orchestrate the downfall of governments.
Well, recall in the early 1970s, in the run-up to the coup against Salvador Allende in Chile on September 11, 1973, the U.S. administration under Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger were saying that they wanted to make Chile's economy scream. And so, therefore, they helped to foment all manner of disruptions in Chile, including strikes, including in transport, making it difficult to get goods to market or to consumers. And certainly, you can see a replay of that taking place in Venezuela. Now, here is where this connects to the problems we're having in the United States right now. That is to say, it was inevitable, it seems to me, that the U.S. ruling elite, which was not above pushing countries into fascism, as Chile was pushed into fascism with the Pinochet coup of September 1973, it was inevitable that the U.S. could not stand above a trend. That is to say, I dare say and believe that there are many, including in the U.S. working class, who may have perceived or thought that they had something to gain from an overthrow of a socialist government in Santiago de Chile. But I'm afraid that that is a misperception. What we're actually seeing is that the kinds of foreign policy strategies that have been foisted upon so-called developing countries, such as Chile or such as Guatemala after the overthrow of the Arbenz government in 1954, and we could go down the list, that the chickens have come home to roost. And now you have this continuing crisis in the United States. The country has yet from the Great Recession of 2007-2008. The country has yet to recover. The wages have been stagnant for about four decades now. The country has yet to recover from the reality that a good deal of the working class, particularly the Euro-American working class, continually and perpetually votes against its own interests, votes for parties that try to foist fascism upon other countries, and perhaps believing that that will redound to their benefit when actually redounds to their detriment. And so what we're facing right now is kind of a perfect storm of incoherence. Incoherence in the sense that the New York Times, once again, will clamor against the rise of what they see as the fascism embedded in the Trump train phenomenon, but at the same time, they're saluting the rise of similar trends in Latin America, not only in Venezuela, but look at what's happened in Brazil since the last time we talked. That is to say, the trial of Dilma Rousseff, who has been temporarily suspended, and by the way, it's possible that she can make a comeback. Let's say she's on trial, and she only has to flip two senators in order to get her job back. It's not as easy as it sounds, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility. In any case, this has driven Brazil. Temer has been catastrophic. I mean, one of the first measures that he's
I wondered what you one of the candidates in this presidential cycle, Hillary Clinton, is particularly known for many foreign policy disasters. President Obama's foreign policy farewell tour seems to be, and I agree with you, seems to be laying the groundwork for her eventual ascendancy to the president, to the presidency. Her foreign policy disasters include Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Georgia, Ukraine, the so-called Asia pivot that raised all these tensions, that has raised all these tensions with China in particular and Russia by proxy. What do you see as the connection between Obama's foreign policy farewell tour, essentially paving the way for Hillary Clinton, and apparently, I mean, she's getting away with any kind of critique, and people are not necessarily making any links about her foreign policy disasters and the foreign policy disasters she may very well continue to make if she is the nominee and presumptive winner of the presidency.
Well, you're putting your finger on one of the prime issues of this electoral cycle. I must say that many of our friends on the left, which I totally understand, when every 4 years they tell us that we must vote for the Democrats because if we don't, the Republican will get into office and therefore the Supreme Court will receive more Republican appointees, and that'll jeopardize women's reproductive rights and the Voting Rights Act and civil rights legislation and all the rest. And I understand that kind of sentiment, but I think what's happening is that many people are tired of hearing that same old song. They're tired, on the one hand, because they're wondering, well, what's the off-ramp to voting for Democrats every 4 years? Are we supposed to be the caboose on that train in perpetuity? And the reason they're raising that question is because when they look at the foreign policy of Hillary Clinton, and as noted, they detect that in many ways it's to the right of Donald J. Trump on key issues such as Russia and North Korea, they wonder if this prospective Clinton II presidency will be a prize of any sort, or whether it is guaranteed to push us into yet another disastrous foreign conflict, which was the hallmark of the Secretary of State's position that she held for 4 years under Obama. Now, for example, you could have mentioned and spent the whole hour talking about this disaster in Libya and how she was the major force in the room calling for the 2011 NATO intervention that toppled Muammar Gaddafi and now has brought Islamic State to power in Sirte, Gaddafi's old hometown on the Mediterranean coast, has converted Libya into a superhighway for folks fleeing not only Libya across the Mediterranean to Europe, but as a gateway for Syrian refugees and also refugees from sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly Eritrea, to get to Europe, which, as noted, to bring us full circle, is having reverberations in terms of Brexit. Because I noticed that when I was in London, the Daily Mail in particular, almost every day they were running a front-page picture of boats filled to the brim with Africans in the Mediterranean trying to get to European shores, and the articles would go on to talk about how they'd eventually get into London and how that would supposedly drive down the wage levels of London workers and all of these horror stories. And so, once again, there's a certain incoherence with regard to the policies of these North Atlantic leaders because, of course, David Cameron was the major cheerleader for this intervention in Libya, which is now backfiring in terms of the Brexit opponents pointing to the immigrants fleeing from Libya into Europe as being one of the reasons why Britain supposedly should get control of its borders and withdraw from the European Union, and by the way, oust David Cameron as prime minister.
That is indeed full circle. But is Hillary Clinton, therefore, because the prime objective here for Obama, one assumes, is that he would leave office on a high note, foreign policy being a jewel in his crown. And is Hillary's history as Secretary of State and even before that when her husband was president and he had his string of foreign policy disasters, is she a drag on whatever it is President Obama intends to be his foreign policy legacy?
Well, I think so. I think so in part because he has his reputation as a hawk. And one of the, quote, secrets, unquote, of the rise of Donald J. Trump has been his scalding, scorching attack on U.S. foreign policy, particularly the ill-advised toppling of Saddam Hussein in 2003 and his attack on NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and his attack on the fact that there are still 37,000 U.S. troops in South Korea more than a half century after the truce was signed, ending the conflict between North and South in the Korean Peninsula. And so that's been one of Donald J. Trump's calling cards, because it's fair to say that many people are tired and exasperated by this U.S. interventionism, not least because it's not, quote, paying off, unquote. It's difficult to see what the working class in particular is getting from these kinds of interventions. And here you have Hillary Clinton who is Madam Hawk number one, who embodies an interventionist foreign policy. And therefore, it seems to me that Mr. Obama, by trying to set the table for Hillary Clinton with all of this foreign traveling, is either A, setting up a catastrophe of the Democratic Party, handing a very powerful issue off foreign policy to Donald J. Trump, or B, perhaps worse, who is to say, paving the way for Madam Hawk number one to be sworn in as U.S. president in January 2017.
Well, and don't forget that if she is in fact elected, she has already indicated that it's a twofer. You get her and you get Bill again, and you know, you have the combined history of foreign policy disasters and foreign policy attitudes that would continue and probably get even worse. I have to ask you, do you consider Hillary Clinton, or do you consider the Obama administration guilty of war crimes?
Well, yes, but the problem, of course, is that that's a question that as of now can only be answered in the abstract. Now, we know that there's a double standard. We know, for example, that Ihsan Habré, the former leader of Chad, was just convicted for war crimes in a court in Senegal. Now, it's interesting, he wasn't tried in The Hague in Western Europe. He was tried in Senegal because the African Union had raised such a clamor about the International Criminal Court going after African leaders disproportionately and overwhelmingly, and giving a pass to Tony Blair. And, of course, the Parliament is about to release a report within a few weeks after the Brexit vote, indicting Tony Blair for his malfeasance and misfeasance and dragging Britain into this war with Iraq in 2003. And certainly with regard to this drone warfare, which has just gone off the charts during the Obama administration, if this were happening, if any other country were involved in such drone warfare, by the way, we cannot rule out the possibility that drone warfare will not just be limited to U.S. military and CIA attacking its antagonists. I mean, drones are not necessarily that sophisticated a technology that other countries, or perhaps even non-state actors, will be able to develop drones as well, which basically means we may be returning to the law of the jungle. And so in order to have some sort of deterrent, yes, we have to have a discussion as to whether the U.S. administration has been guilty of war crimes.
Wow. Much more to follow upon. The hour went by so quickly. I want to thank you so much, Gerald. It's always an education talking with you. We have to schedule because I keep getting bombarded with demands and requests that people want their own time with you in a Q&A. So we'll try and see if we could get that scheduled. We also have to talk about your most recent book on Paul Robeson. But it is always a great education talking with you, and we are privileged to have you in our midst. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of our program. Much to think about from what was said. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. I always like the name of that program, Expanding Mind. You can reach me at Lead Stories, LEID, stories, plural, at gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Tomorrow is Free Your Mind Friday, so get your brains in gear. Thank you so much for being with me today.